Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, for those who don't know me, my name is John Evans. I'm the Senior Vice President of the Institute. Jenny, the President, would like to send her apologies. We banished her to Tasmania, so that fixed her. Now, and you're going to have somebody much better looking than me to close. Nicolette, the Vice President, will close the event today. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Today we have 80 attendees, and 50% are actually not members of the Institute, which I think is great. And it just shows how the profession is actually reaching out to other people in the risk management space. The program recognises the extent to which the profession can provide advice beyond the insurance sector. Discussions around a very broad range of issues: conduct risk, risk culture, and how to respond to risk. One area where I think the profession definitely needs to do more is actually around conduct risk in the financial sector. I think it's something we're going to have to take on. One of the reasons is that certainly in insurance, I think the profession is the best equipped to understand the consumer value issue. And therefore, we really are going to have to do some more work rather than somebody tell us. I'd also like to thank Brett and his committee and the Institute's events team for organisation of today. It looks like a great day. On behalf of the Institute, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our sponsors, RSA, Finity, and Willis Towers Watson. I'd now like to invite Brett to chair the next three sessions. Brett is the CRO of Arch LMI, Australian Lenders Mortgage Insurer. Prior to this, he's 17 years' experience in the general insurance area as an actuarial consultant, mostly with Finity. Brett's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and a chartered enterprise risk actuary. He's the convener of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. Brett, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Welcome, everyone. On behalf of RNPC and the organising committee, I'd like to welcome you all here, both members and our non-member guests. We've got a fantastic attendance here in Sydney, and we've also got some good representation on the webinar as well, including quite a few people overseas. So welcome to the people joining us on the webinar. As per last year's program, for those of you who attended the same event last year, we have a range of people speaking on a range of topics with significant experience, so hopefully you'll get some good value out of today. We have a range of people represented here today as well, so we've got CROs, risk managers, specialist risk analysts, actuaries who work in a range of roles, and also non-executive directors, so a range of views and experiences, and hopefully we have some rich discussion throughout the day. I'd also like to welcome the media who are here today, and I think there's quite a bit of interest among the media with a couple of our sessions, so hopefully we'll have some good discussion to support that. So the theme for today is responding to risk. Basically, how do companies and individuals prepare themselves to manage and minimise the threat or impact of risks that are either materialised, so something like perhaps a business continuity event, or a risk that maybe hasn't materialised but obviously still poses a threat to the company. The topics we cover are universal, but there is a distinct financial services flavour to what we're going to talk about. As everyone will be aware, banks and insurers have been in the press in recent times, not always for the right reasons. And I think we'd all agree inadequate risk management has often been associated with a lot of those events. Today is not about theory, it's about practice. So as I said last year, it's a formula-free zone. We haven't policed it with vetting the presentations, but hopefully it is a formula-free zone. Today's seminar will be broken with two breaks. The first, morning tea, so I'll chair the session is taking us up to morning tea, so the keynote, plenary one, plenary two. Lunch. After lunch, Pauline Blight-Johnson will chair plenaries three and four, and then after afternoon tea, Vern Baker will chair plenary five, and Nolan Wolfe will finish up with leading plenary six. We'll start today with a keynote address from Ian Lachlan, who'd be known to many of you. There'll be opportunities for questions and discussion at the end of his presentation. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Ian to give the keynote address. I'd like to advise that this session is open to the media. Ian Lachlan is the chairman of ANZ's OnePath Life and General Insurance Companies and ANZ's Lenders Mortgage Insurance Company. He also chairs the advisory board of risk management and board performance consultancy Black Hall and Pearl. From 2010 to 2015, he was a member and deputy chair of the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, as most of us know it. His careers included senior management positions in financial services in Australia, Hong Kong, and the United Kingdom, including various board roles. He's an actuary by profession, but he's also a strong proponent of robust risk management and the critical importance of an appropriate risk culture. He's also been an active volunteer for the Institute, including a term as my predecessor as convener of the Risk Management Practice Committee a few years ago. Now, you'll probably all be aware that our keynote speaker did, or originally scheduled keynote speaker did pull out about a week and a half ago. He's not here. I called Ian, and fortunately he was able to step in at short notice. Ian, you wouldn't be aware, but you were the first part of our contingency plan that we had drawn up, so it was risk management in practice, if you like. But notwithstanding the change in schedule, obviously there is a lot of interest from the media, and I think that's testament to Ian's position and experience in financial services. Not just his APRA experience, but also I think a lot of his views on risk management were forged through his time working, particularly in the United Kingdom, and observations on risk management there at a point in time. So as far as I'm aware, Ian's never owned a silver Ferrari. I don't think he's ever been the federal member for Wentworth. However, I'm also sure he's never got himself in a tangle over taxation on birthday cakes. With that, please welcome Ian to the lectern.
Thanks very much, Brett. Let me pick up on one of Brett's points there. So how can it be that institutions spend huge amounts of money on resources and intellect, three lines of defence, huge risk management, infrastructure and teams? How can it be that they do all of that and yet we still find calls for a Royal Commission? Or, if you're on the other side of politics, there's no need for a Royal Commission, but multiple inquiries will do the same thing. Okay, so how can we actually be in that position? So it begs the question for me, is conventional risk management working as it should? And so I've had many years of experience in the business world, and as Brett just said, as a regulator, and I've seen many different things, positive and negative, that have shaped my views on risk and risk management. But interestingly, it's experiences in more recent times that are exercising my mind the most. So it's more experiences in more recent years that are really challenging my thinking. So today I want to touch on a few areas where my thoughts are evolving. Social risk, risk sensing, culture and regulation, all in the context of this question, is conventional risk management actually working? I have two sons. Son number one is fairly conventional in his approach to education, did well, went off to university, etc. Son number two, much more casual about the idea of education. Studying and so on was sort of a foreign idea. And when he was young, we'd often have these conversations about whatever might be topical. And so from time to time, we'd have a conversation about something, you know, reasonably profound. And I think, well, actually, Mark, that's pretty good. And so I'd say to him, Mark, where did you get that from? Where did you get that thinking from? And he would say, more often than not, oh, it was on The Simpsons. And as a parent, you'd say, oh, okay, should I encourage him to spend more time on The Simpsons because he's actually learning something? And or should I actually discourage him and say, look, you know, that's a ridiculous place to learn something. You know, you should be learning in a more conventional way. And incidentally, I often agreed with what he learnt on The Simpsons. So that was a bit of a worry as well. And incidentally, these days, if I say to Mark, you know, we have another good conversation, I say, where do you get that from, Mark? And he says, Reddit. And for those of you not in the know, Reddit doesn't mean I read it in the Sydney Morning Herald. There's an app called Reddit, and there are subreddits. And if you've not had a look at it, you should go and do so. It's quite interesting. Okay, so I was reminded of all of this with the advent in recent times of fake news. You know, the phenomenon that we've seen in the US in particular. But that's in the backdrop, in the context of the fact that we as a society have never had so much information available to us. As you know, it's multiplying at a huge rate of knots and so on. And there are so many different sources of information, not just The Simpsons, but lots of others as well. So much so that it can be overwhelming. At the same time, we society, have never had such power, such an ability to express our views and to promulgate those views. Now, those views that we promulgate may or may not be consistent with the facts. And so we have this sort of paradox. There's a whole lot more information available to us, but there's also a lot more wrong information available to us. So let's go back to fake news and the so-called post-fact world. Now, we've seen fake news in action in the US, as I said, but we've seen it here as well. So just yesterday in The Australian, Jacqueline Maley wrote a story on a photo of the Prime Minister with his grandchild. And I'll spare you the details of the story, but she finished up with this statement. When the media confect a story about a non-existent public outrage and then seek comment on that outrage, well, what can you call it but outrage? Okay, so that's an example of this sort of false news accumulating and being promulgated and so on. Now, when I say fake news, do I mean fake news being presented as the truth or the truth being called fake news? Don't know. And then, of course, we can have fake news where you know, somebody's called something as fake news, but somebody says, actually, that's fake. You know, that's not right. It's really correct. And so where does it end? And more importantly, what's the relevance to financial services in Australia? And one of the points of relevance is that there's a risk to institutions with the power that society has to make fake news. Okay, that's a risk out there. I'm not saying everything that you see about financial institutions is fake news, not true, but it's absolutely a risk. So I want to make it crystal clear here that I don't defend the financial services industry for its past practices and some of the dreadful behaviour that we've seen when it actually occurs. And in my working lifetime, I have seen many appalling examples of behaviour and standards. And so I believe most of the criticism that you see of financial services is justified, most of it. Interestingly, especially for somebody that's been around for as long as I have, the standards today are actually much higher than they were in the past. So if you go back 10, 20, 30 years, the standards in financial services were absolutely dreadful. I mean, absolutely, some of the things that I've seen in my lifetime are just appalling. And so you have this strange situation where the standards have been lifted and lifted and lifted. They've never been any higher. And yet we're still on the front page of the news. How can that be? Okay. So society has stepped in two ways to help lift those standards. First of all, society's expectations are, quite rightly, much higher than they were in the past. And tolerance for egregious behaviour is much lower. You know, you as a consumer won't put up with being treated the wrong way, whereas people just took it on the nose years ago. And then secondly, society's ability to see and to call out unacceptable practices and outcomes has become so much greater. There are tools available, social media and so on, that can be used to help your cause. All right, so fake news is a weapon that can be used against financial services organisations to great effect, fairly or unfairly. Now, fake news is an example of what I might call social risk. And this is the risk to a business that comes from changing social attitudes and norms underpinned by new social capabilities. So I'll come back to the social risk in a minute. The social capabilities, I mean Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, cameras in every pocket, that sort of thing, all of which empower the everyday person in ways unimaginable not long ago. Right? So the consumer society has got a lot more power than it used to have. So let's have a look at some examples of social risk. Now, I've already touched on fake news and the power of social media, but there's also the power of trolling. And so if you have a group of people or a subset of society, they can use social media, and they do, or online comments on newspapers or whatever, to push their view. Okay, so you can see the power of an accumulation of people getting together and pushing their point of view and influencing outcomes. Mental health is on there because of the impact it's had in life insurance. So attitudes, social attitudes to mental health have changed dramatically in the last 10 years or so. Once upon a time, if a person was mentally unwell, A, they may not have even acknowledged it to themselves. They certainly didn't talk to other people about it. And so they therefore didn't even think about the idea of going and making a claim on their insurance policy for mental health problems. Now, that has changed dramatically. So mental health is a major source of disability claims in the life insurance world. There's increasing preponderance, and they tend to be fairly long tail claims if you've got a disability income policy. So there's an example of changing social attitudes that have had a direct financial impact. Litigiousness, so that society is much more willing to engage lawyers to pursue a claim, and the life insurance world sees that alive and well all the time. Now, I almost never listen to daytime radio, but I happened to be out in my car the other day and I turned the radio on, and I was amazed at how often I could hear advertisements from lawyers saying, I can help you with these claims, right? So it's actually an industry. It's a big industry out there. Sense of entitlement, you know, there are lots of different views on this, but senses of entitlement are certainly changing over time. There's issues of generational inequity, which we see in the housing market in Sydney in particular all the time. I touched on cameras. The fact that cameras are everywhere means that issues, events can be captured in ways never considered in the past. And then there's the waxing and waning of regulation and deregulation, and I will come back to that specifically. Now, you can argue that banks have been hit because of changing social attitudes as well. For example, society has become far less tolerant of poor practices, so pricing of products, behaviour of the banks or bank staff, the remuneration, the pay of the people in charge of the banks in particular, and especially in the context, you know, there's this sort of outrage in the community of how come these people get paid so much money and yet they do so many wrong things. You know, there's this dichotomy. How can that actually be? And of course, the politicians understand this as well. So, you know, if belting the banks is good politics, then they'll belt the banks. Okay, so let's consider that in the context of capabilities. I think that financial services businesses should have deep expertise in monitoring society's attitudes and norms so that they can anticipate possible pressure points and address them early. And that's not as simple as it might sound. I'll just go through this very quickly. There's a professor at MIT, Peter Glore, who's looked at ways to monitor changes in society's norms and attitudes. And he's got three sort of groupings. One is what he calls crowd analysis, which is basically Twitter. And then there's swarm analysis, which is Wikipedia, Facebook, group chat rooms, and so on. And then expert analysis. And basically, he argues that crowd analysis is not really a good way of understanding sentiment because Twitter tends to be a bit shallow and it's often about self-promotion. Expert analysis, the third one, can be flawed because so-called experts are usually being paid or often being paid to express an opinion. So MIT's focus is then on analysing the swarm, where individuals come together independently to debate and comment upon relevant issues in detail. And this is where sentiment analysis of social media can be more useful. So if a financial services business wants to monitor society's changing attitudes and norms, it's not as simple as just running focus group sessions or monitoring social media. It depends on what social media you're monitoring. And note, when we're talking about society here, customers and staff are particular subsets of society which are very important for a financial services business. Now, as Brett mentioned, I chair the advisory board of Black Hall and Pearl, which is in a risk management advisory firm and a board performance firm. And they do some fascinating work in helping businesses identify the key influences of culture and behaviour through social network analysis. And they use both what they call human social network analysis, which is sort of conventional thinking, but they also use an artificial intelligence tool developed in conjunction with Peter Glore, the guy that I mentioned earlier from MIT, that can automatically analyse social network influences and so on. So it's really very interesting. And this is all in its infancy, but there are these great opportunities to better understand what's happening in society and hence for financial services organisations to better manage what I call social risk. Now, a bit too fast. Here's an idea worth thinking about, that a financial services business perhaps should have a social risk officer, somebody who's absolutely focused on the risks that emerge from changing attitudes and norms in society and is expert in assessing and interpreting various sources of information about those social attitudes and norms. I think it's so important that organisations understand this, it might be worth doing that. Okay, so let's look at a different world altogether. I want to talk about the Tesla, you know, the electric car, autopilot. The autopilot is the technology that allows the car to drive by itself, and in particular to deal with the risks of collisions and accidents, which, as we all know, we've all been in cars, most of us would be drivers. It's a very complex process. Now, Tesla, the autopilot system, it works by monitoring a multitude of risks in real time. It uses radar and ultrasonics and cameras. There's forward-facing cameras, there's backward-facing cameras, there's ultrasonics, there's long-range radar, there's short-range radar, and so on. And it's constantly monitoring things that's happening around it. Now, it doesn't just report in real time. You know, it doesn't flash a red light and say, well, look, you know, if you keep driving like this, that car is going to hit you at the next intersection. It actually starts to respond and take action. Now, imagine if we had such capabilities in risk management and financial services. So we've got all of this monitoring capability out there, and it's in real time feeding information back to us. And I'm not just talking about hard numbers, right? Not just the, you know, financial risk has risen because volatility's increased or something like that, but some of these social risks that I've been talking about, attitudes of staff, behaviour. You know, imagine if you could monitor behaviour in some sort of real time that would alert you to the fact that something's about to go wrong in a part of the organisation. So that leads me to the idea of risk sensing, risk sensors. Now, risk sensing is a much richer term than risk monitoring, especially when you consider it in the context of the Tesla model. And I wish I'd invented this term because I really quite like it, but I find that Deloitte is way ahead of me and has been using it for a while, and I'll come back to that. So what do I mean by risk sensing? I mean monitoring and interpretation of the information that flows from the various sensors that a business should have, which provide information about risks. So not the conventional sort of risk indicators, but some of these richer sources of information. Now, many of the current risk sensing capabilities that our financial institutions employ are actually fairly basic, and they're often backward looking. So if you think of, you know, somebody sitting in the back seat of the Tesla and saying, oh, it's pretty good, you know, we haven't hit anything yet, right? That's sort of the approach that's taken. Or, you know, another analogy is we all have a risk of our house, our residence burning down. So what are good indicators for you to use in monitoring that risk? Well, in financial services, some indicators are like monitoring whether or not the house has caught fire. You know, if it's caught fire, well, the indicator is red. If it hasn't caught fire, the indicator is green. We already know the house has caught fire if it's caught fire. Okay, you don't need an indicator. So, but it's surprising how often the indicators in financial services are like that. Okay, so so Blackall and Pearl do a lot of work with indicators, and I just want to share some of the feedback that they've given me on what they see with indicators. An indicator should be leading in nature. In other words, it's telling you that the risk is changing and so you're looking forward. And here they say, many of the indicators we see in organisations are typically providing lagging data. Right? And they make the point further, a leading indicator is a quantitative measure of the root cause, so root cause of the risk. And often you see these indicators not telling you about the root cause, they're actually telling you about outcomes. And then the second bullet up there is, I won't go through it all, but most KRIs we see tend to be associated with process and system factors, but just as important are people and external factors. People factors can involve behavioural drivers, and external factors can involve issues that are often outside the control of the organisation. So these are really important things which are often missing. Now, to gauge the current state of risk sensing, Deloitte, in a survey conducted with Forbes Insights in 2015, asked C-level executives in large organisations about their company's risk sensing capabilities. So what do they say? So the risk sensing capabilities often miss key elements, lack technical depth, analytical sophistication, or reside in narrow technical units. They fail to focus broadly enough or otherwise leave the organisation open to the very risks that risk sensing should be detecting and monitoring, but otherwise it's okay, right? So that's a pretty strong criticism. It then goes on to talk about risk-powered performance, which can create value from risk by moving early to address nascent market movements and customer needs. So there's this idea of anticipation, monitoring what's going on, looking ahead, and getting much better outcomes for the business as a result. Imagine if all of that was happening in real time. That's the interesting thing for me. Okay, let me touch now briefly on risk culture. This is something that I've spent a lot of time on in my time at APRA and elsewhere. So what is risk culture? You know, I don't want to dwell on this, but and I know there are sessions later in the day, but in simple terms, from my point of view, this is the impact of a firm's broader culture on its risk management, or in simple terms, how we do risk around here. Now, culture has always been important to risk management and outcomes. If you go back and read the 2004 APRA report on the NAB Forex problems, where they lost some hundreds of millions of dollars from unauthorised trading, the APRA report makes the point that culture was at the heart of the problems, right? So that's 2004. In 2015, CPS 220, you'd be well aware of this, I think, for those of you in financial services, included some specific requirements on risk culture. And I just want to share some of what I saw then when I was at APRA and what I've seen since in the director community. When CPS 220, the first draft of CPS 220 suggested that the board should have some role in monitoring and influencing risk culture, there was actually some degree of shock and even outrage in the director community. You know, that's not the job of the board, it's management's job, and so on. Now, as a regulator, I firmly believe this myself, as a regulator, that I think that's completely wrong. Because the board can and should understand the risk culture in their organisation and should ensure that where it's deficient, something should be done about it. And that's basically what CPS 220 says. The board has to form a view. If they find the risk culture is deficient in some way, they have to ensure something is done about it. So there was a lot of debate, and the words were tweaked, they were changed to come up with the final version, which I think is actually very effective. And I say that not just from my time at APRA, but from what I've seen since. And I think it's fair to say that boards are, you know, have sort of embraced the idea that they need to have some responsibility here. And it's not that unusual for boards to say, actually, this is pretty good. You know, we're actually learning about our organisation here. We're better understanding the risks and how they might emerge and indeed how they might be influenced by risk culture. And so this whole idea, though, is very much in its infancy. So it's an evolving issue. Boards are just starting to come to grips with it. They're looking at the multiple ways they can actually get a handle on what the risk culture is. And there are many different ways, things that you can do to get some sort of indication. But it is in its infancy. And I know from talking to people, the sort of status is in different organisations, or varies a lot from organisation to organisation. And APRA will probably tell us more about this later on. But what it does mean is that the skills and understanding in this area will need to improve markedly. So boards need to keep working on this. Management, particularly the risk function, need to be become much better, understand the whole issue of risk culture and how you can monitor and influence it. They need to be much better at it than they are today. So this is a work in progress and it will continue to evolve. All right, let me just touch briefly now on regulation. Okay. So as you know, I've been on both sides of the fence most of my working life in industry, but 5 years at APRA. And so let me start by making it clear that based on both periods of experience in the industry and as a regulator, that I'm absolutely categorically in favour of strong prudential regulation. Now, I don't have time to go into what strong prudential regulation actually is, but I think it's fundamentally important to the financial services industry that we have today, given its complexity and so on, that we have really strong, robust, particularly supervision, prudential regulation. Now, over the years, though, we've seen government's interest in regulation wax and wane. When I first started in financial services, the law for superannuation, covering everything, regulation, laws, and so on, was a few paragraphs, literally a few paragraphs in the Tax Act. You could read it in 2 minutes. That was it. Now, contrast that with superannuation today. The law, the regulations, prudential standards, all those sorts of things, the volume is huge. Okay, now, it partly reflects the more complex world that we're in, but also says that society has changed its view and has decided that regulation is critically important for sound operation of, for example, the superannuation industry. It's also, of course, this growth in regulation has partly been driven by scandals, things actually going wrong, and the growth in consumerism and politics and so on. Financial system inquiries have driven the change. Now, when the Coalition came to power in 2013, it made it clear that it wanted to reduce the burden of regulation. And I think reducing the burden of regulation is a worthwhile intent, because there's no doubt that the regulation that we have in place is overly complex and actually quite difficult and drives inefficiencies. Now, that means there is a room for a lot of improvement, and I think we as an industry should be encouraging regulators to continue to refine and simplify their requirements. That doesn't mean that the requirements should be less stringent or less tough, but the whole system, I think, could operate more effectively and more efficiently. And it's interesting, isn't it, with the current government, how it's gone from the idea of, you know, let's focus on reducing regulation, it's too intrusive and so on, to, in more recent times, let's give the regulators more power because financial institutions have not behaved in the way that they should have, and therefore we need more regulation. Now, that'll wax and wane over the future, but that's where we sit at the moment. It's quite an interesting position. With that, Brett, I think I might finish and we can take some questions.
Thank you, Ian. Right on time. Thank you for a very thoughtful and wide-ranging presentation. So we have 15 minutes now for Q&A and discussion. I've got a couple of questions, but we might throw it open. Anyone in the audience like to lead off? A couple of questions over here.
Thank you. I quite enjoyed your analogy of the Tesla autopilot, but then if I suppose look to history, you know, we look to stop loss limits and things like that, they've almost formed a part of the problem rather than being the solution. I just wondered what your thoughts were on how things had matured in order that these types of, I suppose, mechanism are going to have a positive impact rather than necessarily the events of LTCM and, I don't know, epic crashes and that sort of thing.
Let's talk about Tesla. So Tesla developed this autopilot, and you might recall there was a death that Tesla drove underneath a trailer. The sensors didn't work properly. The trailer was going across the road, and it drove underneath and killed the person. And that caused all sorts of outrage that these automatic cars are going to be dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. They've now done studies overseen by relevant government bodies in the US that show that collision rates, accident rates for Teslas with and without autopilot, they can actually do both. So with autopilot, collision rates are 40% lower than without autopilot. So there's no doubt about the risk that you mentioned. You know, potentially in financial services, they could be used in a way that produces perverse outcomes, or you know, people can say, well, I'm not accountable because it's automated and so on. So you couldn't just do this without really understanding how it might work, and you might want to ease it in the same way that Tesla is easing in the capabilities of autopilot, right? They haven't thrown them all on the table. They give more and more power to it over time. But I do think there's, you know, as an industry, we should aspire to the sort of thinking that's behind the Tesla autopilot, not necessarily replicate that, but that sort of thinking. You know, why shouldn't we be so good at this that we actually know what's happening in real time and we can respond in real time and head off the problems at the pass instead of what we see right now?
Okay. I'm sorry, I should have said at the start, if you can just introduce yourselves and wait for the microphone as well, just so the people on the webinar can hear the questions and discussion. Next question, Stephen had a question at the back, down the front first. Yep.
G'day, Michael Rodden from the Australian newspaper. Looking specifically at the CBA and AUSTRAC case, you were at APRA during the time that these smart ATMs were introduced, and there's been some, you know, comment about Laker also, who's conducting the review into CBA, was also at APRA during that period. Where do you think CBA went wrong in its risk culture or risk frameworks, and does APRA have anything to answer for in the fact that these machines weren't compliant when they were introduced?
Okay, so let me do a show of hands here. Who thinks if I answer that question, I'll get myself into trouble? Thanks very much. It's a good question, though.
Doesn't know how to use the microphone.
Is this working? Excellent. Quick question about social license and regulation. They seem to be interlinked in that we had a theme of reducing regulatory burden, and we seem to have had a number of institutions have recently lost their social licence. Do you want to, can you talk about the interplay of regulation and social licence, and is it one, is this ongoing cycles, or is there something else at play?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. Yeah, look, I think there is an ongoing cycle. It waxes and wanes, you know, as events happen, attitudes in society changes, but it's like the share market. It's sort of doing this, I think, over time. So social license, the idea of a social license, you know, if you go back 30, 40 years, you know, people wouldn't have known what the heck you were talking about. You know, we've got a right to be here. We've been here for 100 years. You know, this is the way we do things. If you don't like it, well, too bad. Now, that's absolutely not the case now, where society says, if you want to be a bank, then we expect you to behave in certain ways. Now, regulation is only one way of ensuring, helping to ensure, I need to be careful of that word, ensure, helping to ensure that banks live up to the standards expected of social license. And it sort of goes back to the points I was making before. Society has now got other leverages, other levers to use, such as social media, to influence outcomes. You know, they can influence politicians to in ways that they couldn't before. They can influence public opinion in ways that they couldn't before. So social license, to me, is a critical aspect of modern society. I think regulation supporting that social license, that is being complementary to social license, is very important, because I think it simply won't work otherwise. But regulation by itself is not enough.
Okay. I think we've got a question down here.
Ian, morning. Rob Curtis, KPMG. How are you? Thank you for your comments this morning. Just wondering, I mean, Australia's system has always had the Twin Peaks, if you like, for a long time. And picking up the theme of social risk and other elements you were mentioning, and where the Europeans and others are going globally, there seems to be now a much greater desire by prudential regulators to also look at the issue of conduct risk. And APRA has always been fairly staunchly of the view, I think, that that's not really an area that they focus on, and that is something that ASIC should be doing. But, I mean, if you looked at the Australian sort of environment, you might say, well, ASIC's fairly light touch in that sense. It doesn't have regulatory teams like the FCA does, dedicated to certain institutions around specifically conduct risk and the treatment, the fair treatment of customers. So I'm just wondering, with APRA's maturity as a supervisor, is there, do you think, a role for APRA to get somewhat increasingly more involved in the oversight and supervision of conduct risk, because we're obviously seeing the flow and effect to CBA and others, or would you still see that, you know, there is a clear dividing line between between APRA and ASIC, or just more generally going forward, what do you think the mix should or could look like?
Okay, so Twin Peaks, you know, conduct regulator as one entity and prudential regulator as another, and I've spent some time working in the UK under extremely difficult conditions when the FSA, the Financial Services Authority in the UK, was a combined regulator. And I saw it in action, as I say, in very difficult circumstances. So personally, I'm a very strong advocate of the idea of Twin Peaks separation, because APRA has got real focus. And as Rob just said, you know, when you've got a prudential regulator, you have people dedicated to institutions. They can focus on those institutions and ensure that they've got their finger on the pulse. If you mix the two together, you run the risk of, and I think this has happened in the past, you run the risk of conduct issues diverting attention of the regulator away from prudential issues. So if you've got them separated and you've got a major conduct issue, well, you've got a conduct regulator who focuses on that. So I'm a strong advocate of the current arrangement. Now, having said that, they do overlap. And so for the system to work properly, you've got to have the right sort of people, the right sort of attitudes in charge of the two regulators. There has to be cooperation between those regulators and understanding of what they're doing and where they will hand things over between one regulator and another. Now, having said that, it does look a little bit like the lines are being more blurred with this proposed BEAR regime. So this is the Bank Executive Accountability Regime that's being proposed by the government, where conduct of individuals within an institution will have an influence on or will be potentially caught by the proposed powers of APRA. So it's quite interesting that where there is a blurring of boundaries here. So how that will play out, I don't know. It will depend on the final form of the regulation and how APRA and ASIC choose to work together. But I do believe strongly in the separation of the two institutions, but with the proviso that they do need to work closely and cooperatively together.
Question over there.
Ashley Palmer from Inheritum. Thanks for your comments, Ian. I'm really interested by this role of
social risk officer. I guess in my role we help quite a few organisations on measuring and maturing risk culture, and I guess there's another role in organisations that I find interesting is there's executive directors responsible for people and culture. Do you sense that they should have a bit more accountability in this?
The quick answer is yes. So I've seen evidence over the years of a disconnect between the risk function and the HR function when it comes to the issue of risk culture. So you can have a situation where, for example, the risk function gets terribly excited about risk culture and goes off and does things which the HR function considers to be their, rightly, probably, their territory. So for this to work properly, that is for risk culture to be understood well, to be influenced properly and get the right sort of outcomes, you need HR and the risk function, both, to have a deep understanding of what we're on about here and to work closely together. And I think if you don't have that, then you're almost doomed to failure. So the social risk officer, where might that person sit? Is that an HR function or is it a risk function? I don't know. It would depend on how it played out in the individual institution. But the important thing is risk culture, the issue that's of particular importance in financial services is a very important issue for both the risk function and for the HR function, and that goes all the way up to senior management.
Hi, it's Natasha Hall from Hall Advisory. I'm interested in the social risk piece as well, and I guess my question relates to social change and I guess in addition to conduct risk and treatment of customers, there's another part of the puzzle, I guess, is the treatment of employees and culture internally.
Yep.
And I guess the move from a hierarchical approach to an egalitarian approach to management over time, which is well underway. And I guess I've seen things in companies that I've worked at before and people being more willing to stand up and voice where there's problems.
Yeah.
And I'm also seeing it where I'm doing risk culture surveys in the financial services industry, and it's coming through in risk culture surveys as well as employee surveys, and people are willing to speak their mind and raise issues with management. So I'm interested in your thoughts around that piece, obviously getting less focus at the moment. The focus is really much on the customer, as it should be, but I guess it's an emerging exposure potentially in terms of both financial and reputational risks.
Okay, so there's a lot in your question there, but I think the main thing is that culture within the organisation is critically important to risk outcomes. So this is why this is focus on risk culture. And you're quite right, generally in financial services and more broadly in the community, there's a shift from this hierarchical approach to a more egalitarian approach. That shift, though, brings with it its own risks. And I think there's an argument, therefore, for an even greater and deeper understanding of the culture within the organisation and how it might be changing as, you know, management changes and the structure changes and so on. Because if you don't really understand that, you could easily end up with significant problems which were not foreseen. So, for example, could you end up with a culture, as you make this shift, away from accountability? Right? We're all in this together. So, you know, it's not my problem. It's Brett's problem. Right? Brett says, hang on a sec. It wasn't me. It was John's problem down there. So, you know, you need to understand that. And the conventional approaches to monitoring and understanding culture and the risks that might flow from that, I don't think stand up. So there are ways of better understanding the culture, multiple ways of better understanding the culture and influencing it. And when organisations are going through these sorts of changes, all the more reason for them to actually engage in this sort of activity.
Probably got time for one more question. And I don't think we've had any over this side. If anyone's saving, sitting on one? No? No one on the webinar? Nothing? No? Susan. Yep.
Hi, Ian.
Hi,
I've just got a question in relation to what you were saying earlier about the incoming bear regime that we'll see. And I'm just looking for your insights in terms of what your views in terms of what's happening in the UK, in terms of their similar regime. And my question is, if there's increased accountability on individual executives, how does that marry up with the role of the board that's governing that company? Is there an overlap there or conflict? And what's your view?
Okay. So there's an awful lot to this issue behind the bear regime. There are other countries that are well ahead of Australia here, and in particular the UK and Hong Kong have both been mentioned as sort of reference points for the thinking of the government in formulating the proposed regime. Now, experience in those jurisdictions varies, and I don't think anybody would claim they've been resounding successes necessarily, but it's fairly early on in the regime. So that's the first point. The second point is APRA currently has an awful lot of these powers that are being codified in the bear regime. So it looks at first blush like APRA has been given a whole suite of new powers that will, you know, could be misused and abused and so on. But as I say, APRA really can get many of the outcomes already if it chooses using existing tools. So that's an important point. So whilst it looks like it's a big change, it's not as big as it actually looks. It's sort of codifying things, which has its advantages and disadvantages. And back to your point then, so what does that mean potentially for the boards? I don't think it means a great deal, to be honest. I don't think it'll have a big impact on the responsibilities of boards or on the way boards conduct their affairs. They will probably be paying more attention to, as often happens when things are regulated, paying more attention to the relationship between the remuneration and risk management, the rewards that people are getting, and look, society is already addressing this. It's interesting, isn't it? So society is already saying very clearly that some of the rewards that are being given in the financial services industry are unacceptable, and you're already seeing when new CEOs are appointed, typically they're getting lower packages. So that's without regulation. That's just society putting pressure on. Back to your question specifically, Susan, I don't see it will have a big impact on boards, not their own responsibilities, but it probably will influence how much attention they give to this sort of activity.
Okay, we're out of time, so please join me in thanking Ian for a fantastic presentation and some great insights.